is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Steve Moore, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
First day at midnight when you're allowed to make recruiting phone calls, I call Tim Duncan. He talks to me. He is so excited to hear from Kent. I said, Tim, I need to see you play, and I'm going to try and get that done. I said, we couldn't come down because it was not evaluation period. I couldn't come down and watch it at Ohio State camp, but we're going to try and get some video on you. And Ricky, really recommends you highly, your brother-in-law and all that. I said, I'm going to call you once a week. I was the first phone call to Tim Duncan.
Dave Grube is a retired college basketball coach whose career included head coaching positions at Heidelberg from 1972 to 1976, Capital from 1978 to 1986, and Kent State from 1992 to 1996. Coach Grube was an assistant coach at Kent State from 1986 to 1992, including my entire four-year career under head coach Jim McDonald. Coach Grube also worked as an assistant at Central Michigan from 1998 to 2005. The owner of a 216-193 career record as a head coach, Grube won two Ohio Athletic Conference titles and made three straight Division III NCAA appearances at Capital. A basketball and track athlete at Northwestern High School in the state of Ohio before graduating in 1962, Grube went on to play basketball for Kent State's freshman team. He turned his attention to coaching soon after graduating from Kent and landed his first college job as a graduate assistant for Coach Al Van Wee at Wooster from 1970 to 1972. We just launched our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. The first show from our newly created Hoopheads Pod network will be popping up on your Hoopheads podcast feed in the next few days. Thrive with Trevor Huffman will take you into the lives, minds, habits, and routines of the world's best and brightest to help you improve your performance. Make sure you check it out. Be prepared to learn from one of the coaches that impacted me as a player and as a person, longtime college basketball coach, Dave Grube.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Clinton here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel, and tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast my former coach at Kent State University, Coach Dave Grube. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be with you.
We are super excited to have you on. You and I got reconnected about, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Got to hop on the phone for about an hour and just talk and reminisce. I'm looking forward to doing that in a more public realm here tonight. Want to go and start by going back in time to when you were a kid, and let's talk about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger.
Mike, we're going to go way back. I am old school. We are going to go way back, but I grew up in the Worcester area in Wayne County, lived in Ohio, of course. And as a kid, Ohio State was the big thing right then, and still is today. But if you remember, Ohio State won the national championship in 1960. And that, we're talking about Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek, all of those guys. And those guys were my idols. I mean, anytime I could listen to them on the radio or watch them on TV, and there weren't that many games on TV then, why I did. At the same time, as a seventh and eighth grader, my high school, Northwestern, which is right outside of Worcester, was winning a state championship and was really kind of a powerhouse locally. And locally, we're talking about Bob Knight, a few miles away at Orville, Bill Musselman, who coached at Ashland, then Minnesota, and then the Cleveland Cavaliers, lived right here in Worcester. And that was a time when outdoor courts were lit and games would go on to 12 o'clock. And I would get involved as a junior high kid in those games. And those were guys that I idolized. And my coaches, the junior high coaches, my high school coaches, Roy Bates, who's a Hall of Fame coach in Ohio, and Dan Baker, another Hall of Fame coach, were really outstanding. And they did a great job of teaching fundamentals. Northwestern, Mike and Jason, did not have football. So everything was basketball and baseball. And we had a player who was really good in basketball, but even a better baseball player, Dean Chance, who went on and won the Cy Young Award. And when I was a freshman in high school, Dean was a senior. And as I said before, Northwestern won the state championship in 1958. And that's when there were only two classes. So it was much tougher to get down to Columbus at that time. But they won it in 58. They were runners-up in 59. And, you know, my coaches were the best teachers at school, and they really motivated me to get into coaching. And so I had a pretty good high school career and you know, was recruited by Division III schools, you know, Ashland, Mount Union, Worcester a little bit, and my coaches encouraged me to go to Ashland, but, you know, money was kind of a problem, and I ended up going to Kent State and made the freshman team. That's when freshmen were not eligible for varsity, so I made the freshman team as a walk-on and really got to play a good bit as a freshman. Had some good games, I remember, against Toledo, and we played Youngstown, and so I was encouraged to come back my sophomore year only to get cut. But the coaches were good enough to me. They said, we'd like to have you maybe hang on. But the same token, they told me there's a coaching job available, an assistant coaching job at Kent State University High School. And they had a new coach because their former coach, Bill Musselman, left to go to Ashland College to become the head coach there. And the new head coach at Kent State University High School, Walt Gilliard, needed an assistant, which was a paying job. So I became his assistant for 2.5, 3 years. And it really started off my coaching career. And by the same token, when I was in the program at Kent State as a freshman player, Bill Musselman was a graduate assistant. And he would coach the freshman team at times. It's funny because right now, Division I programs probably have on the staff maybe 6 or 7 people. At that time, there were only 3 coaches at Kent State University in the program. Bob Dahl was the head coach. Art Welch was the assistant. And the second assistant was Bill Musselman, who was a graduate assistant at that time. And not only was he a graduate assistant in basketball, but also football. And then he went on and made, you know, had a great career as a basketball coach, as I said, at Minnesota, Ashland, Minnesota, and then with the Cavaliers. My high school coach, Dan Baker, when he left Northwestern to go to Marion, and he told me, well, when you get out of school, I'm going to have a job for you. So I thought, well, I'll go over and be his assistant. So I graduated from Kent, went over to Marion, only to find out that Coach Baker, his philosophy was, well, you're going to have to work your way up. So Marion had 3 junior highs, and the junior highs were grades 7, 8, and 9. And Coach Baker said, I am going to put you in the worst junior high. We very rarely get players out of Edison Junior High, Dave, and you're going to have to coach Edison Junior High. You stay there a couple years, and I'll move you up to the high school. And the only teaching job they had was English, and I did minor in English at Kent. So I had to teach English. And I coached junior high basketball, and in 2 years we won the championship. And you know, I worked my tail off developing players, and a lot of the players that ended up playing for Marion Harding then were guys that came from Edison Junior High. The only problem was once I was moved up, And this is before Title IX, really. So it was boys basketball, and I was the varsity assistant, Mike and Jason. And as a varsity assistant, I was there for all the varsity practices, which went from after school until around 6 o'clock. Then the JV team would come in. I also had to stay for those practices. So I was basically in the gym after teaching 5 classes of English. I was in the gym from like 3:30 until 8 o'clock at night, only to go home and have to grade English papers. After about 2 years of that, I thought I've got to do something else.
That sounds like a fun time, Dave. That sounds like a fun time, grading all those English papers.
Oh, my. You can't say, well, just change papers and grade each other's papers. You're grading themes and all of that. You can relate to that. So
that's why I teach math.
There you go. You can change papers there. So I found out that the College of Worcester had an assistant coaching job. And I thought, well, I have no chance of going from a high school assistant to a college assistant. But, hey, I'll try. Their assistant at Worcester, John Halls, left his position as an assistant at Worcester to go with Bobby Knight, who now was the head coach at West Point. So I interviewed for his position and had a great interview. Al Van Wee, the head coach at Worcester, we really hit it off, and he saw that, you know, I was, you know, my philosophy was man-to-man defense and could teach fundamentals, shooting and all that. And so I got hired. The only problem was they did not, at Division III, you have to teach as well as coach. And they didn't have a teaching position in the phys ed department. However, I had got my master's degree at Bowling Green, and I did have a master's degree in guidance. So I half the job was working out of the dean's office, and they had an apartment set up for my wife and I in one of the men's dorms. So we had to live in a men's dorm, and they had a nice apartment set up. I mean, beautiful, but all their rooms were adjacent to the hallway. So I would be out scouting and recruiting on Friday night. My wife would be left alone in a men's dorm, maybe taking a bath or trying to watch TV, and guys out on Friday night, students would come in, knock on the door, not realizing it was a coach's apartment. After 2 years of that, it was kind of tough. And God bless her for putting up with that. But we had really 2 good years at Worcester. We were 23-3 my first year. We had a really good guard named Tom Dinger. And so in the basketball camp at that time, Worcester had the first basketball camp in Ohio. And Mike and Jason, the camp drew roughly around 400 kids a week. We would go 5 weeks with 300 to 400 kids a week. You don't see that now because of AAU and everything. But a lot of these kids were guys that would go on and play Division I basketball. And the camp would run from Sunday, that's when kids would check in, until Saturday noon. So after 5 weeks of that, I mean, if you didn't love basketball, why, you were in trouble, because it really drained you. But what a great camp and just a great experience. So after 2 years at Worcester and living in a dorm and being Coach Van Wee's assistant, I felt I was ready for a head job. And Worcester was a member of the Ohio Conference. And the Ohio Conference, really a strong Division III conference. There were 14 teams in the conference. And the 14 teams were, you know, like Wittenberg, Capital, Baldwin-Wallace. The worst team in the conference was Heidelberg. And they were 2-19 2 years in a row. The Heidelberg job came open. I applied for it and got the job. So now I'm a head college coach at Heidelberg at the age of 28. And I got on campus, and I soon realized I soon realized how they were 2-19. I mean, everything was football. Basketball wasn't very important. They were at the bottom of the conference, but we rolled up our sleeves and went to work. And in 4 years, why we had a winning season. In fact, my first season, the first game we're playing Marietta, we had to start off with a conference game. So we're playing Marietta, who was supposed to be pretty good that particular year. Phil Roach was the head coach, former assistant at Ohio University. So he brought his team into Tiffin to play us over Thanksgiving vacation. So I come out on the we come out on the floor for pregame warm-up for the game. I think there were about 50 people in the stands. 50 people. Half of those people left at halftime because the football team was returning from winning the Stag Bowl. So it was a downer to win our first game and only have less than 50 people in the stands. Me coming from Worcester, where the last game I coached at Worcester, we played Capitol in front of 3,000 people. People were lined up at 5 o'clock down Bell Avenue to get into the gym to see us beat Capitol. So it was kind of a downer, but it was a great place for him to start, and we were able to recruit some good kids. And from there, I went to Capitol, really a good situation, another Division III school in the same conference. And, you know, we were able to get teams in the NCAA tournament. And I was fortunate to interview for some head Division I jobs. I interviewed at Akron, only to lose to Bob Huggins. I interviewed at Youngstown State, and Jimmy Clemens, a former Ohio State player, got that job. I interviewed, and I told Mike this the other day, at Capitol 1 year, I think it was 1982, we get in the NCAA tournament. We go down to North Carolina, upset the number one team in the nation in the regional. We go then out to California to play Cal State Stanislaus, where we lost. And we did all this without our best player, Eric Morrison, who was from Lorain Admiral King, who tore a tendon in his ankle and couldn't play out there. Otherwise, we might have won a national championship that year. But anyways, we get back Sunday, and my phone rings. As soon as we walk in the house, we get back from San Francisco, walk in the house, my wife and I, and get a phone call from Kent, Paul Amodio, the athletic director at Kent. And he says, Dave, you may or may not know, we have an opening for a head basketball coach. We'd like to interview you if you're interested. Do you think you'd be interested? I said, yes, but I really need to notify my president and the people that I'm doing this. He says, well, we're kind of late in the process. I said, well, when would you like to interview me? He said, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock up in Aurora. So I drove up there without notifying anybody to the Aurora Inn, walked in. They have a big conference table with about 15 people sitting around. I interview, I think it goes pretty well. But during the interview, one of the questions was, well, we really haven't been able to attract blue chip athletes to Kent. How would you do that? How would you overcome that? And my answer was, well, a good friend of mine is Jim McDonald. And I know he's the assistant coach at Toledo. And I said, I know what they do. They really try and get players, recruit players who are very passionate about the game. They have a good work ethic. They're goal-oriented. I said, you can win that way. And that's how I would try and win at Kent. Long story short, Jim McDonald gets a job at Kent. And I told him later, I said, I got you that job because I talked about you a good bit during the interview process. So stayed at Capitol a few more years, and then Coach McDonald contacted me. He said his one assistant was leaving, and he said, if you'll come up to Kent with me and help me maintain the program or build the program, you know, you'll have a good chance of getting the job when I retire, which I don't see myself coaching that much longer. So that's how I ended up being the head coach at Kent. So that's kind of my coaching career. And I did meet Coach McDonald when I got my master's at Bowling Green. That's how I met Coach McDonald. He was an assistant at Bowling Green at that time. And I would go to classes in the morning, and then I would go over to his office in the afternoon, and we would talk basketball. And that's how I developed a relationship with Jim McDonald. And he would come down to Capitol. He came down a couple times to watch my teams practice, and you know, we developed a good friendship, and I enjoyed. Of course, that was Mike's head coach at Kent. I enjoyed my time. I think I ended up spending 6 years at Kent before I became the head coach there.
So let's go, before we jump into the Kent stuff, let's go backwards and just kind of talk through just maybe the differences in each of the levels as you remember, as you were going up through the ranks, because clearly you kind of had a stepping stone. It was a ladder as you went up and sure. started out in high school, or started out with junior high and then to high school and then to Division III, and then you end up at Division I. So just maybe talk just a little bit about the differences from when you went from high school to college for the first time, and then maybe when you went from an assistant to a head coach, and then when you went from the transition from being a head coach at the Division III level to an assistant at the Division I. Maybe just talk a little bit about each of those transitions.
Sure. Well, Mike, starting out coaching junior high, I think every coach should have to start out coaching junior high, because those kids are old enough, they're developing strength and agility and athleticism. They can learn the fundamentals. And I think if you can teach junior high kids who have no bad habits, most of them, at least at that time, they didn't. I mean, everything they learn, you're teaching them, you know, whether it be shooting, footwork, all the fundamentals. So that made the transition to high school easier. And like I said, a lot of my players at Edison Junior High in Marion then became, when I started coaching at the high school level, a lot of those guys I had at the junior high level were now the high school players. And Marion really had a good program. My high school coach, Dan Baker, was an excellent coach. In fact, he had a player by the name of Al Raleigh that played at Ohio State. Dave Merchant played at Ohio State. And when I was Coach Baker's assistant at Marion, after the games, there would be Division I coaches there to recruit Dave Merchant. And I would be standing outside the door, locker room door, anxious to meet these guys. And all of them would say, boy, your team is so well coached, meaning Coach Baker's team. He said, how does your coach get players to pass like that, move like that? And that was Coach Baker, because Marion was in the Buckeye Conference. And I'm not even sure, Mike and Jason, if the Buckeye Conference exists today. But we were going against players. Finley was in the conference, and Finley had a player by the name of Dave Sorensen, who probably you guys don't know, but he became an All-American at Ohio State. Scott May played at Indiana. He played for Sandusky. Tom Dinger, the All-American at Worcester, he played for Mansfield Senior. Lorraine Admiral King had James Bubble Harris, who played at Indiana. They had Tom Plinscales, Dave Bellick, that played at Kent. So, I mean, we were going against, and Elyria had, they came out on the floor 6'9", 6'8", 6'7". Jay Underwood, a player by the name of Mongers, and all that played Division I or college basketball. So, Coach Baker, lots of times our tallest player would be 6'3 or 6'4. So we really had to do a good job teaching fundamentals, and everything was man-to-man defense, and what became known as freelance offense, which later became known as motion offense. And Coach Baker was just an excellent coach to learn from. And he was my high school coach, and fortunate enough that he hired me later at Marion. So you know, from there I had a good background in basketball going to Worcester with Coach Van Wee. And Worcester was loaded. I think, Mike, a lot of the players that play 3 or 4 years at the Division III level could play Division I basketball because, you know, they're going through the strength program and all the practices and everything. In fact, Tom Dinger, the All-American guard at Worcester that was a senior my first year as an assistant at Worcester, he was offered a scholarship by Kent. He played the North-South All-Star game, had an outstanding game, and he was offered a scholarship at Kent, but opted to keep his commitment to go to Worcester. So, you know, the players at Division III, they're not as big, not as athletic, but skill-wise, they're just as good. And the passion for the game is at an all-time high. And that's the thing. You know, they're paying because at Division III, you don't have scholarships. Everything is based on financial aid. So those guys are working in the summer. Their parents are forking out money for room, board, tuition, and all that, so they can go to a smaller school and play basketball. So you know they love the game. While Division I, you know, I found that maybe you're going to have some players that they're playing just because they're getting their education paid for. They're on full scholarship. And most of the guys, Mike, and you weren't one of them, you loved the game. You worked your tail off. And most guys do. But you would come across some guys that maybe didn't love the game as much at the Division I level, but they were playing because they were on scholarship and it was paying for their education. And that was a big difference.
Yeah, that's honestly been a theme that has run through a lot of our interviews, Coach, with coaches at all different levels, is just talking about how underrated the skill level of players is at the Division III level. And we've had a number of Division III coaches on over the course of the time that we've been doing the podcast. And a lot of them have said to us, you know, we'll sit down with kids that we're recruiting and they'll kind of look at us sideways, and they don't really, because everybody obviously is focused on having an opportunity to play Division I. And so in a lot of cases, people are looking down at a Division III school. And the Division III coaches have said to us, well, when we sit with a recruit, a lot of times we'll ask them, well, have you ever even seen a Division III game? And like 75% of the time, the answer from that player and their parents is no, they haven't even seen a Division III game. So they really have no idea what the level of play is and how good the players are. And to your point, I think that when you think about the difference between the Division III level and Division I level, in so many cases, it's the athleticism and the size is what is the separator. It's not necessarily the skill level. It really is just, if you have a guy who's 6'8", 225 versus another guy who's 6'3", 185, it's just going to be a huge difference if they both play the same position. The 6'3 kid is just not going to get the same opportunity at the Division I level that the 6'8 kid is going to get. And I think that speaks to a lot. I relate completely to that story that you just told. And I know I've told this story from my perspective a couple times on the podcast about my recruitment. And I don't know how much of this you'll remember or not remember, but my recollection of it is that back in sort of the fall of my senior year, that I know it was you and it was Coach McDonald. I can't remember which of you or how the conversation came to pass, but I was invited down to come for an official visit. I think it was in the fall of my senior year. And I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to take an official visit because, you know, I only get 5 of these things. And, you know, North Carolina is going to be calling and Duke's going to be calling and Ohio State's going to be calling. And I don't want to waste one of these visits going to Kent with on, but I'll come down to campus. I came down with my mom. And I remember meeting with Coach McDonald. I remember you being an integral part of that and us sitting down and talking to you as well. And then my mom and I going to Wendy's on campus and eating lunch by ourselves that we paid for. And I just think back to that time, and it's always funny to me that I just didn't have, like, I had no idea. Obviously at that point, there was no chance whatsoever that any of those schools were going to be calling me, but because there wasn't that much information out there and my high school coach, Mr. Casey, had never really had somebody recruited at that level. So he couldn't really necessarily guide me, and my parents, I was the oldest kid, so they had never had that experience and I really had no idea. And so you go into that and you're like, boy, that was really a mistake. And then it felt like, okay, you guys kind of had backed off of me throughout the year. And then I know Coach came and saw me one time, I think my last game, maybe as a senior at home. And, you know, and then I was the last recruit in a group of 7. And and it just so happened that I ended up in the right place. But I think that going back to this Division I versus Division III discussion, certainly the people that were the most interested in me throughout the entire recruiting process were Division III schools. I mean, Coach Moore, who we had on, who's a friend of yours, I always remember him being, he came to a bunch of my games, and there were a lot of Division III schools that I'm sure would have been happy to get me. And I was at the time one of those kids who said, I want to play Division I. And I often have Jason heard me say this a few times. I looked at guys that were in my class that I played with in the summertime and that I had played against a lot. And I would see, oh, this guy's signing here and this guy's signing there. And in my mind, I kept telling myself, I'm as good or better than those guys. How come they're getting a chance to go and play at these schools? And here I'm just kind of sitting around waiting. And so when the offer came in from Kent, for me, it was a no brainer to take it and go and test myself and see if I could do it. And obviously for me, it worked out really, really well. But it's just, it's funny how just some small different changes in the, you know, somebody else doesn't accept the scholarship. There's an extra scholarship available. I happen to be in the right place at the right time. And all of a sudden I'm at a place where it ends up being a great fit for the kind of player that I was. And I end up getting a chance to have a really nice career. And I think it could have gone a lot differently in a lot of ways. I think I could have gone to a lot of Division I schools and maybe got buried and not gotten a chance to play. Or I could have gone to Division III and maybe had a really, really great career and been a star for 4 years. Who knows? But it's just interesting how things, you know, how things can turn out when just with a small difference in what happens in terms of being offered a scholarship or not being offered a scholarship.
That's you're absolutely right, Mike. And when I was at Capital, we wanted to play Division I schools. And when I was at Capital, 1 year we played Kent, Ohio U, and Bowling Green. And we gave all of them a game. In fact, we lost to Kent on last second shot. And, you know, now, to be honest, sometimes those guys take the Division III schools a little lightly. Maybe they probably don't play their best. But we were in the game. And I remember a kid named Robert Kitchen from Detroit that played for Kent put in a half-court shot to beat us when I was at Capital. And we played Miami when they had Ron Harper. And we gave them a game. We were in it down the stretch, and I think we ended up losing by 8 or 9, something like that. So, you know, we're talking about Division III players versus some pretty good Division I players. Another story, where you had left, or you were not at Kent when Jay Peters, you remember Jay?
Jay was before me, so we just had Jay on the podcast. I don't know if you got a chance to check that out, but yeah, we had Jay on about, I don't know, maybe like 3-4 weeks ago. And it's funny because Jay then spent a bunch of time playing with our summer team that we played in, like the Cleveland Pro-Am and the whatever used to be called the sports festival. This was mostly after I had graduated. Maybe it was at some point during, you know, in between in the summer. I can't remember what the time frame was, but Jay played a lot on our team. And as we were at some point, I was cleaning stuff up and I went through and I found this old team photo of our summer league pro-am team. And so we had some guys from Cleveland State, and Jay played with us on that team, and Scott Roth, who I'm sure you remember. Scott played with us on our team. And so I found this like motley crew of us all after winning the pro-am down at Cleveland State. And, you know, we're all sweaty and we're holding the trophy. And it's just, it was Jay's given another kid on our team bunny ears in the photo. So I took a photo of that and sent it over to him. He got a kick out of it. So yeah, Jay and I actually kind of became pretty good friends right after that. And then again, as time goes on, you just don't talk as much as you had previously. But yeah, Jay was a man. He was fantastic.
Really a good player. Well, you know, Mike, he played for his dad at Medina. No, I'm sorry. He did not play for his dad, but his dad was an outstanding coach.
Yep.
At Medina. And oh, I forget the name of Jay's high school coach at Medina.
I should know because we just talked. Talked about it. Yep.
Al Darner was his name. And Al Darner's son then played at Purdue, and now he coaches at Wisconsin Green Bay. But Jay was signed at Kent by Jim McDonald. And so Jay started out at Kent. Now, Mike, let's think back here to Coach McDonald's preseason conditioning program out of the stadium. Okay, the mile run and all the jumps and agility and all that and the power index.
I've heard all about this, Coach. I've heard all about this conditioning regimen. I have. Mike's told me.
Jason, it was a bear. It was a bear. And then you play pickup games. Well, Jay had a tough time making the mile run. But anyways, he left camp before he even played as a freshman. And I think the preseason conditioning program and the mile run did him in, because Jay could never make the mile run time. I mean, he'd have to get up in the morning and run and all that. So Jay transfers to Grove City. All right, I'm in my last year at Capital. Jay's a player at Grove City. We play Grove City in the Kenyon Holiday Tournament, and we beat them pretty good. We were really worried about Jay, but we did a pretty good job defensively on Jay. So this is before Christmas. So I'm in my office. I think it was right after Christmas. The players had not come back from the short Christmas break yet. I get a call from Jay Peters. He says, "Coach, I really like the way your team plays. I want to transfer to Capital." I said, "Jay, you want to transfer to Capital?" I said, "You started out at Kent. You're at Grove City Division III school, and you want to transfer to another Division III school?" I said, "I don't know what I can do for you financial aid-wise." He said, "I really want to play." So we set up a visit. Jay comes. We talk a little bit. I take him over to the admissions office. He's meeting with a counselor over there by the name of Bruce Green. I said, "Bruce, I'm going back to my office. Call me when you're done with Jay." It only takes about half hour, 45 minutes. Bruce Green calls me at about 10 minutes after I took Jay over. He said, "Coach Grube, do you know that he went to the Kent State, Cleveland State game last night, met with the head coach, Jim McDonald, and Jim McDonald had a scholarship and said, 'Jay, this is your scholarship. If you'll come back to Kent,'" I said, "send him back over here." So Jay comes back over. I said, "Jay, what are you doing?" I said, "You have a chance to go back to Kent on a full scholarship. I don't know if I can give you anything. Your parents are going to have to file a financial aid form and everything. Coach, I really want to come to Capital." So we met about a half hour more. I sent him on his way. I said, "You think it over, talk it over with your parents. Give me a call when you decide." He calls me the next day, "Coach, I'm going to go back to Kent." Good decision, Jay.
Good decision.
Good decision.
It's funny because when he told that story, he said that when he left Kent that first time, he got in the car. He said as he was driving back to Medina, he was already in his head thinking, "This is the worst decision that I've ever made." And it was interesting to hear him tell that story, because obviously I knew the general parameters of the story, that he had been at Kent and then left, yes, and gone to Grove City and then come back. But I had never really talked to him in depth about sort of the why. And he talked a lot about going through the whole conditioning program and all that. And then he's like, "How dumb was I? I went through all that hard part and then was going to get to the season where you could actually play. And I missed out on all that and just had to go through the whole preseason routine." And so he just said, "Yeah, that was the worst decision of his life," and he knew it almost immediately but he got back and he obviously had a good career at Grove City and then had an outstanding 1 year that he was able to play at Kent. And he went on and played a couple of years with Athletes in Action. They got to travel the world, yes, and play some more basketball. So I think it all turned out okay for him the way that, maybe it was meant to be, that that's where how it should have worked out for him. But he certainly had the ability to play inside and out, and would have, I'm sure, had he stayed and been at Kent for 4 years, would have had an outstanding four-year career instead of just an outstanding one-year career, because he was a bear. He was kind of more of a modern player when you think about his ability to play inside and out. He had the ability to step out on the floor and shoot, and then he could also go down and post up and score on guys. I loved playing with him when we played together in the summertime. He was just a guy that you could count on and get buckets for your team.
You nailed his game, Mike. I mean, you nailed it. I mean, if you look, and again, in fact, and I know you were at the Grove City Elmhurst NCAA
yes
tournament game when Jay's son was playing. And I talked to Jay. Every time I see Jay, he talks about that mile run, having to try and run that mile run. I mean, it's really in his head. He said, "I could have tried that for a year and never made that time." They just kept getting worn down and worn down. But, you know, running up and down the floor was not Jay's game. But, boy, oh, boy, what a player. In fact, we played that year that Jay played at Kent. In fact, it really wasn't a year. It was just a half a year because there was a mix up on how much time he had left, how much eligibility he had left. So his first game, I know we were halfway through the year. And this is when I then joined Coach McDonald as an assistant. So I ended up getting to Coach Jay as it was anyways, because after that year, I went from Capital to Kent with Coach McDonald as his assistant. And Jay then just became eligible at mid-year. And the first game he played was against Ball State. He made an impact on that game. But then in the tournament, in the MAC tournament, we're playing Central Michigan in the championship game. And Jay has the ball driving for what would be the winning basket. And he traveled. His Converse shoes did not hold up, and he slipped and traveled. And so we talk about Converse shoes all the time with Jay. But no, great, great player, and really had a good coaching career too. And
yeah, he really did.
Just retired this year, but what a great career.
Absolutely. And it was really nice for me to reconnect with him there, because like I said, we had kind of, you know, spent that time playing back in the day. And then, as you know, once you get busy and you have a family and you're moving around and doing things, and it just becomes more and more difficult to stay in touch with people. And so it was really nice to reconnect with him, and not only on a podcasting level, but just on a personal level, to be able to reconnect and kind of reminisce and go back through some of the things that we experienced together back in our time. And here's how I want to talk about our years together at Kent, and tell me if this makes sense to you. What I think we should do is, I think we should each trade out maybe a story that we remember, and then get the other person's perspective if they remember the story. So I've got a couple of good ones that I want to throw out there and just see what your recollection, or even if you do, some of them you may not even remember, but just throw out a story or two from our time together, and then let the other person kind of react.
I'm going to be really helpful at this part of the conversation. Yeah, guys. I was 4 years old. Dave, I was 4 years old when this happened. So,
Jason probably won't be of much value. So,
I'm just going to enjoy listening, guys.
You want to start, or you want me to start?
No. Well, one thing I remember, Mike. One thing I remember, and you really, and we talked about this before. You were really the part of really a good recruiting class. I mean, we're talking Tony Banks, right?
Yes.
Jerome Sims.
Yes.
Harold Walton.
Yes.
You. Todd Rowe.
Yes.
I mean, there were some really – you came in a real good class, and probably one of the more talented players in your class was Banks, Tony.
Yep, absolutely.
And you remember Tony's defensive habits, if you could even call them habits. They weren't very good. And Coach McDonald, he would start off a lot of practices with defensive slides. And Tony just, I mean, holy mackerel. I mean, and Coach McDonald would say, get down there and get him in a stance and get him moving his feet. There was no way Tony was going to get in a stance and move his feet. And that was just trying to get him to concentrate, get him in a stance. That was not Tony's game. A talented player, but he was not going to play defense.
I remember Tony always kind of having like a hunched back rather than bending his knees. And I remember the coaching staff collectively always being frustrated with, you know, just say, Tony, get in a stance. And he would get in a stance, which was like the Tony Banks stance. And I think you could just, like, I could still almost visualize either you or Coach Smith, and we were freshmen, just kind of going and trying to like push his lower back in and trying to get him to have a straight back, and just not being like, I can still picture what his stance looked like for sure. And Tony was obviously, I think our last 2 years, he was our leading scorer when I was a junior and a senior, and just as a super talented guy, really athletic. And definitely over the course of time, I think I would say, a clash is maybe too strong of a word, but definitely had a difference of opinion, I'd say, with the coaching staff at certain points.
No doubt about it, Mike. No doubt about it. You're right. It was a challenge. There's no doubt about it. And I, speaking of defensive slides, I remember keeping you after practice a couple times and getting you in the lane for lane slides and getting you to reach step and everything.
Yeah.
And you got things done. I mean, you had no problems doing it, and it was just a matter of giving you your reps and things like that. And that's my story. I'm sure as a player you have some stories that I haven't heard and maybe right. shouldn't hear.
So all right. No. I have some good ones that I don't know if, again, I don't know how much of these you'll remember. I have one that I know you, let's start with the one that I know you won't remember probably, but it's one that I found to be funny in the moment. I think it's probably still pretty funny. We went down to a tournament at Tennessee Chattanooga, and we flew in there, and I think if I'm not mistaken, we went from the airport, got on the bus, and went right over to their arena, which was beautiful. The Roundhouse. I don't know if you remember their arena. That place is probably one of the nicest places I think we ever played while I was there at Kent. And I remember we were going through and we were doing our stretching and we were doing our UCLAs, and guys were kind of looking around and talking amongst each other that the floor was kind of slippery. And I remember, you know, you're rubbing the bottom of our shoes and we were just kind of talking about it. This is probably all in the first maybe 5 or 10 minutes of practice. And I remember Coach McDonald, as all this little conversation was going along, he turned to you and he said, "Coach, is the floor always like this?" And I just remember this look on your face, looking back at him like, "Coach, I've never been here either, so I don't know really what the floor is usually like." Like, I just remember almost feeling bad for you in the moment that, like, I don't know how Coach Grube is supposed to answer that question because he's never been here, just like any of us have never been here. So we don't know what the floor is normally like, and we certainly don't know if it's different from how it usually is. So I always got a kick out of those kinds of moments where coaches – we had Matt McCall, who is the coach at UMass, who worked with Billy Donovan, and he told a story about how one time during a game that Billy Donovan was up coaching in the middle of the game and all of a sudden turned around and started yelling that he wanted a paperclip. And the coaching staff was all kind of looking around at, like, why does this guy want a paperclip? But yet everybody's kind of falling all over themselves to help their boss to get this paperclip for who knows what reason. And I remember that being a moment. That situation that you was at Tennessee Chattanooga where, you know, you got asked this question and I don't know how you would even possibly begin to answer that question.
Well, Coach McDonald could do that to you. he could. I remember, you know, another question he asked me. We played Cleveland State your senior year up there. We lost. Yep. You remember that game?
I do. Yep.
And it was Harold Walton's first game back from his leg.
Yes, he had the blood clot in his calf. Yep.
And he had a terrible shooting game.
I broke my nose in that game.
Now I forgot that. Did you really?
Yeah, I ran into John Wilson's elbow fighting through a screen. And so that was in the first half. And my nose was all bloody. Went in at halftime. And the doctor looked at it and said, "I don't think it's broken."
Now that makes sense, Mike.
What's that? What makes sense?
It's your nose. I'm just messing with you.
My nose is crooked, but I had it fixed that time. That time I remember, Mike.
I do remember that now that you mention it.
Because I had to wear the mask. You remember me wearing the mask? I had to wear the mask.
I do. You were
the original LeBron and Kyrie with the black mask, Mike? Or was
it wasn't black. It was white, and it was homemade. It was a piece of, like, perforated plastic that Terry Slattery had to take and mold onto my face in order to get it to match. So he heated it up and then molded it to the shape
you
of my face.
You still have it because you could use it right now.
I wish I had it. I don't have it anymore. I wish I did. just as a memento. But sorry, Coach, I didn't mean to interrupt your story about Cleveland State.
That's all right.
Go.
Anyways, we lose to Cleveland State. You have a broken nose. Harold Walton has a terrible shooting game. Okay, he just can't hit anything. So on the way back, Coach McDonald says, "Why do you think Harold didn't shoot the ball well?" And I said, you know, I didn't have an answer right there. I said, "Coach, I don't know." He says, well, you better find out. You're the one that's down there with him all the time. I didn't want to say, well, this is his first game back. You know, that's funny. Was Coach McDonald. Jay Smith and I were talking the other day how Coach McDonald could really put pressure on assistants, which when you become a head coach, you do the same thing.
Right.
No doubt about it. But, you know, you're and I'm getting off the beaten path here, but a couple of things. You know, growing up, I don't know if you had someone that was an idol to you that you really looked up to and copied and emulated, but I had a guy by the name of Robin Freeman, an All-American at Ohio State. Have either you or Jason heard of Robin Freeman?
I have not heard of Robin Freeman.
Would you Google him when we get off? He had one of the first jump shots. And I would look forward every November to getting the basketball magazines like Street and Smith and all those when they come out. And I got one when I was a seventh grader that had a picture of, because he was an All-American at Ohio State. They had a picture of Robin Freeman shooting a jump shot. And I had that picture up my bedroom wall, and I copied his jump shot the best I could. I mean, he was a guy, I idolized him. Okay,
I can't believe Mike doesn't know who he is. He played for the St. Louis Hawks.
I do not know Robin Freeman. I honestly have never heard that name. That makes me feel bad.
I totally Wikipedia'd it. But
well, look him up at Ohio State. He was an All-American.
Two-time All-American. Two-time All-American.
At Ohio State, one of their first All-Americans. So later – you know, this was when I idolized him. It was like 1957, 1958, maybe even 1956, my first start playing basketball. So now it's in the 1980s. I'm the head coach at Capital. It's in the summer. Hardly anybody's on campus. I go across to the campus center to get something to eat. I'm coming back, and there's a guy in a suit with a briefcase walking out of the gym, and he says, could you tell me where – law school building is. Capital had a law school on campus at that time. I said, yeah, it's right over there. I said, by the way, I'm Dave Rube. I'm the basketball coach here at Capital. He said, well, my name's Robin Freeman. He said, I'm a lawyer from Springfield. I'm supposed to lecture a class on campus today. And it was Robin Freeman.
Wow, that's
awesome.
Do you know
why he never played in the NBA, Dave?
Well, he was only 5'11". I know he was only 5'11", and he was kind of a – I really don't. I know he got injured.
He severed the tips of two of his fingers while chopping wood.
Yes, yes. And a lot of people, Jason, thought that he did that on purpose because he was so high-strung and put so much pressure on himself and would get so down on himself. But, yeah, the story was that he did it chopping wood. Wow. So maybe that's why he didn't play in the pros, for sure. I mean, that would have been kind of tough.
That's funny. That is funny.
Mike, I got another story. Jason, another story. Okay.
Go for it. We're ready.
Okay. So at Capital, I had a player. If there is such a thing as a Division III walk-on, I had one. His name was Ricky Lowry. Ricky was only 5'9". He played high school ball at Bishop Hartley. And he didn't play for us, but he was a good teammate. He was a member of some of the NCAA tournament teams I had at Capital. Ricky was quick. You know, he's the type of guy you joke that could turn off the switch to on his bedroom wall and be in bed before the lights went out. He was just quick, really quick. So years later, I'm the head coach at Kent. Okay, I get a call from Ricky. Coach, my brother-in-law is living with us this summer here in Columbus. He's a swimmer. But I think I'm working with him on his basketball. I think he's someone you should recruit. He's pretty tall. He's about 6'10". He said he's kind of rough. He's got some rough edges. I'm going to send him to the Ohio State camp. But I think he's someone you should recruit. He's going to be with me a couple more weeks, and he's going back home. I said, okay, Ricky, you give me the number and everything. He said, well, his name's Tim Duncan. And I said, okay. I said, we're not allowed to make calls to recruits until July 1st, but I'll call Tim. He lives in Ricky told me he lives in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. His mother had just passed away and all that. So I make all the arrangements at midnight. The first time, I think it was July 1st. I could have the date wrong, but it was the first day at midnight when you're allowed to make recruiting phone calls. I called Tim Duncan. He talks to me. He is so excited to hear from Kent. I said, Tim, I need to see you play, and I'm going to try and get that done. I said, we couldn't come down because it was not evaluation period. I couldn't come down and watch it at the Ohio State camp, but we're going to try and get some video on you. And Ricky really recommends you highly, your brother-in-law and all that. I said, I'm going to call you once a week, Ricky.
That's crazy.
Not Ricky, but Tim, I'm going to call you once a week. The following week, I go to call him. He doesn't give me the time of day. By then, he's got so many divisions. He ends up going to Wake Forest, as you know, and was All-American and had a great career with the Spurs. But I was the first phone call to Tim Duncan.
That's incredible. Well, it's also that Russell Westbrook was his choice before UCLA. He was being recruited by Kent, correct?
I think so. I did hear that, Mike.
I'm pretty sure that before UCLA got involved, that Kent was one of only a couple schools, I think, that were recruiting him, and that there was a decent chance that he was going to go to Kent.
The reason Russell Westbrook didn't come to Kent was he couldn't live up to the legacy that was Mike Klintzing.
That's right. There you go.
That's possible.
He couldn't match the athleticism. That's what it was. That was his problem. He couldn't match the athleticism that I was able to bring to the table. All right. So I got another story for you. Seems like all my stories are bad, but that's okay. They're all
– Well, those are the stories. Those are the stories. Players –
You never remember the good ones. You always remember the bad ones.
They're not bad. They're not bad. They're more funny, especially in the moment. So there was a time where – and I can't remember the circumstance. I want to say I think it was after one of the Saturday morning practices followed by the blue-gold scrimmage, and coach got mad, kicked us out and sent us up to the locker room. And then when he came up to the locker room, he took Eric Glenn's stool and threw Eric's stool and broke it. And then the next day before practice, when we were meeting in the locker room, and of course all the players are in there before any coaches come in, and the only thing left of Eric's stool is just the top round part with his name and number on the stool. And Eric, you know, we're all kind of talking about it, you know, hey, Eric doesn't have a stool. And obviously we're all sitting on our stools normally. So there was this big internal debate amongst the team of what should Eric do because he doesn't have a stool. What's going to get him and us in the least amount of trouble when coach comes in and Eric doesn't have this stool to sit on? Should he stand? Should he, what should he be doing? And so he made the decision to sit down, like set the round circle top of this of the stool on the ground and then sit on the stool. And I can just remember all of us sitting on our stools waiting for Coach McDonald to come in and then just trying to figure out what was the reaction going to be when he came in and saw Eric sitting on the floor on this stool. Was he going to be mad? Was he going to be stoic? Was he going to think it was funny? What was going to happen? And he came in, and I remember it was a light moment in that he came in and looked at Eric and just kind of started laughing, and then everybody started laughing, and it was a memory that was kind of I started out by saying bad, so it's not a bad memory. It's actually a good memory because it was one of those times where you kind of saw everybody kind of come together and be able to laugh and joke. And I still remember vividly just the tension in the air in those moments before coach walked in of what is he going to think here when Eric is sitting on this stool. And when I talked to Rick Blevins the other day, we were talking about that story, and Rick's like, he goes, I think Eric might've been the only person who could have gotten away with that at that point, that coach would have thought it was funny. He goes, it would have been anybody else. I think coach would have been mad.
That is funny. I vaguely remember that, Mike. I do. But you're right. Eric could get away with a little bit, no doubt about it.
Another saying that I remember coach always saying was, you know, we had to weigh in after practice. And I remember one time that I don't know, Eric had a bad practice or something Eric did that upset coach, and coach came up to Eric or in the locker room, or maybe it was on the practice floor. And he just said, Eric, you're killing me with that 211, man, the 211 pounds. You're killing me with that 211. And I don't remember what he wanted Eric to weigh or not weigh. But just, it was one of those things that you're like, yeah, I don't think if he weighs 209 or he weighs 211, it's really going to make that much of a difference. But it's just one of those sayings that kind of sticks with you again as a player. There's things that stick in your mind that you're just, you know, I can't, it was funny hearing him say, you're killing me with that 211.
Well, you know, coach really loved John Wooden and had a lot of John Wooden sayings, I think, up in the locker room. And I remember one being, many players are not complete players because the only time they play hard is when they have the ball or when their man has the ball.
Yes. I remember that.
Put that up there or not.
Yep, but, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. I think about there was a lot of John Wooden things that coach would say and that coach would do, and that kind of, you know, you think about the philosophy or even the warm-ups that we did that we called UCLAs, and I still use some of those same things with teams that I've coached with my own kids. I still call them UCLAs, and it's amazing that whatever it's been 30 years after the fact that you're still using some of those things. And I've said it numerous times that I ended up, I think, in the right place with a coach who appreciated the type of player that I was and what I was able to bring to the table. And we were talking about, you know, having me stay after or do lane slides or things on the defensive end of the floor. And I've relayed this story on the podcast a couple times. And, you know, I think back to when I was a high school player, and certainly not that I didn't play defense, but defense wasn't necessarily what I would have been known for as a high school player. And then I got to Kent, and my freshman year, I played sparingly, I would say 4, 5, 6 minutes a game, maybe. Sure. And then the following year, started looking around at, well, what is this lineup going to look like? And what is going to be needed in order for me to be able to play? And I sort of transformed myself into a defensive player, not by any, you know, necessarily improvement in skill. It was just a mindset shift of, if I want to get on the floor, I've got to be able to play defense, because this particular group of players isn't going to really need me to be a scorer. And so I kind of transformed and figured out how I could fit the role that was going to enable me to get on the floor. And I think I always try to tell players that story to help them to understand that sometimes the role that you want, sure, everybody wants to be a 20 point a game scorer and put up as many shots as you want, but sometimes it's just fun to play. And maybe I'm only going to get 6 shots a game, or I'm only going to average 8 points a game. But if I can be out there playing 35 minutes a game because I can defend somebody, I think there's a lesson out there for players at all levels, is that you can just shift your mindset and fill the role that your coach is asking you to fill. And I think that when I think about my time at Kent and I think about playing for Coach McDonald, those are the things that really stand out to me, is just the opportunity that I was given and then taking advantage of it and then being able to have a really good career and being able to play a lot of minutes and start a lot of games and go to a lot of great places and play with a lot of great guys. And I'm so thankful that the opportunity, like we talked about right off the beginning, you know, there was a lot of things that had to go right almost accidentally for me to end up at Kent. And for whatever reason, I ended up, I think, in the right place.
No doubt about it, Mike. And you did. I mean, you accepted your role and improved as a player, which brings us to today's players, many of them, because a lot of them in your situation would have said, I'm out of here.
Right.
I know if I go somewhere else, the coach is going to see how good I am, and I'm going to play, and I'll probably average 30 points a game, and I'm going to have a better role. I'm going to be happier. I'm out of here. That's why you have almost over 700 players today transferring at the Division I level, transferring. And if the NCAA, and maybe I think it was today they were going to decide, makes it you can transfer one time and be eligible immediately, I mean, that's just making things so easy for players. When things get tough, I'm out of here.
Happening, though, because of what's going on right now? Is that going to be like a standard thing? Because from what I've been reading, mixed messages on that, Dave, do you know, or no?
Jason, I have too. I don't know the final decision or if they're going to, but it sure is being talked about. And even then, something closely related is the grad transfer, where you can get your degree, and if you have another year of eligibility left, you can transfer and play. And that really hurts the mid-majors, like the Mid-American schools. And I know Kent lost a big player a year or so ago. His name escapes me, but the kid was a starter for him. He's playing. He gets his degree. He goes to Illinois, where he barely plays at all. But you know, they think, well, bigger is better, and it's not. So there are a lot of rules. But if this does go through and is permanent, you can transfer one time and be eligible immediately. I mean, that's really going to be bad.
Yeah, that's going to be really difficult on the mid-major schools, because then it's almost like they become a farm system for these bigger universities, where, you know, I come in, I have some success. If I do have some success in my first year or two, now I'm almost a proven commodity on the college level. And so now it's easier for a bigger school to take a chance and say, wow, this kid's already produced at the college level. We think he can now produce at a higher level. And it clearly makes the kid think that they can go ahead and leave. And then from a mid-major standpoint, you're developing those kids for a year or two, and then they're out the door and you're losing them, and you're having to start over. And that's a really, really difficult position to put mid-major Division I coaches in and mid-major Division I programs in, where I just think that you're going to open those floodgates. And that's a rule that I think I could see 2, 3, 4 years down the road, they start reevaluating that. But again, the bottom line for that probably is that the power in college basketball is with the Power Five conferences, and that rule is not going to affect them too dramatically, except for the positive that they don't have to, you know, if I can get a scholarship from a kid, give a kid who averages 16 or 17 points a game as a freshman at Kent, and I can give that kid a scholarship versus maybe an unproven high school player who I don't know what they're going to be, and it's my fourth scholarship and it's not a blue ribbon top 50 kid, why wouldn't I give it to somebody who's already proved themselves at the college level, as opposed to a freshman who I don't know what this kid is. I don't know what their work ethic is going to be like. I mean, obviously you can try to project it and figure it out, and that's what recruiting is all about. But if you can find somebody who's already proven it at the college level, to me, it would seem like those players would be far more valuable than a high school recruit, unless you're talking about getting a top 50 or top 100 talent.
Sure. Well, it's just not getting in. And I really think, you know, the players leaving early, I really think John Beilein left Michigan because of being frustrated with players leaving early and having to replace those players every year. You know, you have two or three guys leaving early that you were counting on. You just got to go right back and recruit. And I mean, it's getting tougher. It really is.
How'd that work out for John?
Not real well, Jason. Not real well. I think he'd be back in Michigan in a heartbeat if he was given the opportunity. Didn't work out real well. Think of what happened at Michigan this year. You know, they lose Xavier Simpson. He's a senior, 4 years. He's gone. Probably the guy that got to play a lot that would fill his spot is a player by the name of David DeJulius. David enters the transfer portal and transfers to Cincinnati. From Cincinnati, or from Michigan to Cincinnati. Purdue has a player by the name of Nojel Eastern, who started, but didn't have a good year. I think he averaged about 4 points, has no jump shot at all. Enters just a few days ago the transfer portal. Where does he transfer to? Michigan. I mean, the decisions some of these guys are making makes no sense at all. And Matt Painter, the Purdue coach, is catching a lot of flack because he goes on the Dan Dockett show and tells it like it is. And God bless him for doing it. He said, you know, hey, you want to go to the NBA? How about making all conference first? You know, how about being good enough to make all conference? And you think you're going to be an NBA player? How about working hard? How about showing up every day for practice, which obviously no Gel Eastern didn't do. So I don't know if he thinks transferring to Michigan is going to all of a sudden open up the floodgates for him to average 25 points a game. But some of the decisions, I mean, we're just making things too easy for players that when things go wrong, there's a way out. They're just not able to face adversity and develop a work ethic and get through tough times when maybe they don't feel the role is as they would want it to be, or they're not averaging, or they don't like the offense. The young man that left Ohio State this year as a freshman, their top recruit, what was his name? Carton, I think. And he leaves. He had some mental health issues, so he leaves the team. He's going to come back. Meanwhile, I'm reading his quotes from his high school coach and his AAU coach that he's not being used the right way at Ohio State. So he ends up transferring to Marquette. I mean, I just.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem, and I think the problem starts back in grade school with the AAU and the travel system, and just the fact that I think no matter what you do with players at that young age and the way the system is set up, that if something's not working out in one place, I just leave and I go somewhere else. And you see it at the AAU elementary school level, you see it in middle school, and then you get to high school, you continue to see it on the AAU side, but you see it even within high school programs, the number of players today that have played at multiple high schools through the course of their career, which is something that I'm sure you never thought about. I never thought about. It just wasn't something that was even on my radar. And yet today it's normal to say, okay, I'm going to start here, but it didn't work out. And then I'm going to go there. And you have parents who are way, way more involved in their kids' careers, so to speak, than they were 20 or 30 years ago, where, you know, in the off season, I mean, my parents came to all my games that were high school games or college games. They were at most of them. But as far as watching me play in the summertime or trying to get involved in any of that stuff, like, that was non-existent. And so My parents didn't have a bunch of money invested in me over the last 8 or 9 years that they said, well, we've been paying for AAU and for you to travel and do all this stuff. Like, I was just playing at the courts that were 3 minutes from my house all the time. And I had all the competition that I needed by getting my car and driving around the city and trying to find games. And unfortunately for kids today, those pickup games that you described early in your life and that I grew up playing in, those games just don't exist anymore. The best players, you can sometimes find a pickup game, but it's not a pickup game that if you're a high-level high school player or you're a college player, you're probably not looking to play in those pickup games at some outdoor court somewhere. Whereas when I was a kid and when you were a kid, that's where the players were. That's where everybody played.
That's so a good point.
It's just it's a different world today, and it starts early, and it just continues on up into the college ranks. I wanted to get your opinion on something that I think is a lot different at the Division I level than it was when you were coaching at Kent and when I was playing there. And that is just the amount of time now that the coaches can put in with the players in the off season in terms of workouts and having guys on campus. And, you know, I think about back when I was playing and our season would end and, you know, we'd do some workouts maybe in the weight room, but there really wasn't any off season workouts with the coaching staff and the players. And I think about now where basically those guys get, it's almost 11 months out of the year that the coaching staff and the players are together. And I think it's probably, and I could be wrong, but I almost have a sense that it's even more insular in that all the players and the coaches spend even more time together, with as nice as the locker rooms are now, and especially at big time schools where these guys can go out and hang out and there's food and there's Gatorade and there's ping pong tables and there's a barber's chair and there's all this stuff. It just seems like, if you spend 4 years in that intense of an environment for 11 months out of the year as an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, that to me seems like especially at the level of intensity that we know Division I programs require, both from a coaching and a playing standpoint. That seems like a lot to me. It seems like almost from a coaching standpoint, and I get the benefits of having the coaches be able to work with the players and helping them improve, and vice versa, the coach gets to work with their players and help their team improve. But it almost feels to me like that break really makes a big difference in terms of coming back enthusiastic. And if you didn't have that break, I just wonder, as a player or coach, what that would be like. What's your feeling on just the amount of time that players and coaches at Division I level today can spend together?
I think it's too much, Mike. I agree with you wholeheartedly. That started my last year at Kent. My last year at Kent, all of a sudden the NCAA okays that you can have, you could only have two players in the gym at one time for individual workouts up to 2 hours a week. I think that's what it was. It's been so long ago. That was 1996. But my last year at Kent, you could start having individual workouts. Now, I mean, basically teams are practicing all year long. And it's just too much. And as we talked about the other day, is the product any better? Are players shooting the ball better, playing better team offense and better team defense? Are they handling their feet better? No, they're not. So I think it's too much. I just do. I think coaches got to get away from players, and players have to get away from the coaches. I remember how excited you were when October 15th came around, the first time that you could put your team together on the floor at once in the new practice uniforms. I mean, that was like Christmas, Mike.
Absolutely. That October 15th day was magic. I mean, you're like, okay, we can finally put aside the agility drills and the conditioning and the 2 mile run and all that stuff, and we can really start to get after it and start to put the team together. And I know from a playing standpoint, that was always a great day, and I'm sure from a coaching standpoint it was too.
Exactly. And now, I mean, you're practicing basically all year long, and I think it's just too much. And lots of times, you know, the coaches aren't on campus. They're recruiting. So I agree with you. I think it's too much. And I don't know when this started. And I don't know if Rick Pitino started it, because I know he was good. He was big on summer workouts. But I think it's too much right now. And I think a lot of coaches, if they were honest, would totally agree.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. I mean, I think from a college coaching standpoint, it's an issue. I think we've talked to a lot of high school coaches too. And I think that the bar for the amount of time that you have to put in to be a successful coach at any level has increased dramatically, simply because of the way that our basketball system has been set up, in that what we talked about a second ago, those high level pickup games and the ability to work on things in that type of environment doesn't exist. So if you're a coach and you're not putting your players through workouts, then you've got to rely upon them to go out and put the time in and do it on their own and organize stuff. And we know that some players will do that, but not everyone will do that. And I think that's where we've talked to a number of Division III coaches, and obviously they're still under that sort of old framework where they can't have that contact basketball-wise with their players in the off season. And we talked to a lot of them, and they're like, yeah, we really like it. It refreshes our batteries. It also puts sort of the onus on the players to, A, organize workouts for themselves as individuals, but also it helps develop leaders, where those leaders, those guys that are, you know, whether they're upperclassmen or just leaders that want to get the team together and organize things so that they can work out or play pickup or whatever it is, it helps to develop that leadership aspect of guys within their program or girls within their program. And it's just, I think there's something to be said for getting away from it. And as much as, like, I think about my own time at Kent, and I can remember that seasons where our season would end and the next day I would go to the annex and go play, just so I could just play, as opposed to being in a formal workout or having a coach, you know, looking over your shoulder. It's just like, okay, I can go and just play some pickup basketball. And I think when you're with your program 11 months out of the year, to me, you're never getting a chance to refresh that battery And I often wonder, think looking at that situation with guys and how they're playing today and going through those programs, and I wonder how 1988 Mike Klintzing would have reacted to having that 11 months out of the year. And again, obviously you would have adjusted and I would have figured it out, but just there's a part of me that says I loved pickup basketball and summer basketball and working on my own so much that I think I would have missed if I wouldn't have been able to do that in the summertime and would have had to stay on campus and just, you know, go through individual workouts and just continue to kind of be in the same environment that I was in all throughout the season, if that makes any sense.
It does, Mike. And I think the summer, the pickup games are a great way to expand your game. You know, I would say to a player that maybe was kind of a role player, hey, you know, work on going to the basket. Don't be afraid to take some bad shots or whatever. You know, just expand your game. And then when practice starts, you know, we'll pull you back in and tell you what you can do and what you can't do. But when you're with the coaches all the time, you know, I'm sure the coach was saying, hey, that's a bad shot. You know, that's don't do this, don't do that or whatever, because that's you're coaching them, you know. And I think the summer is a great time to expand your game and maybe develop some areas of your game that you know, presently don't have.
Yeah, pickup games, just for me, I've always said it. I think that one of the things that I learned more than anything else was you had an opportunity to play against guys of all different skill levels, all different ages. And if you're a 15-year-old kid or a 14-year-old kid, it was probably about the time that I started going and trying to work my way into games with older players and adults. And even if they weren't very good, if you're a 14-year-old kid and you're playing against somebody who's 27, and they may not be the best basketball player, but I can guarantee you they don't want to get embarrassed by a 14-year-old kid. And so they're going to bump you and bang you and do all kinds of things to try to stop you from scoring. And those are things that helps you develop as a basketball player. It helps you figure out how to use your body and how to do different things, and helps you to stand up for yourself and develop that part of your character as well. Because nobody's going to stand up for you out on the playground. You got to figure out how to advocate for yourself and get yourself into games and fill your role so that people who maybe like to score a little bit more, you can pass them the ball, or you better make an open shot. You better make an open shot when they pass it to you if you're a 14-year-old, or you're not getting picked up again.
That's
and
right.
those are things that I just think kids today, because they only play with fans in the stands, with mom and dad there, with a coach, that you made a great point of, hey, try some things that you don't normally do where there isn't a scoreboard and there isn't a ref and there isn't a whole bunch of, quote, pressure on you. You're just playing for fun. And kids today just don't get to do that nearly as much as kids grew up in past years. And I think there's benefits. I've said it before. There's benefits to the system today, and that I think in some cases, not all, but in some cases, kids get exposed to better coaching. I think there's more knowledgeable coaches out there at the youth level than there was when you and I are growing up. Like, basically, my dad helped me, and other than that, I never had a coach other than my high school coach. And as far as like off-season workouts and that stuff, it was more me putting those things together and trying to figure it out. Whereas today, kids have trainers, and they go and they get – I think they're more technically sound. They're probably more skilled. Like, if you think about the 12th man on a high school team today, they're probably more skilled than the 12th man during the time when you were playing or I were playing. But at the same time, I'm not sure that their basketball IQ, especially amongst the best players on high school teams, I'm not sure the basketball IQ is higher with players today.
I would agree. I would say one thing. I don't know if players shoot the ball any better today than I think shooting on the part of a lot of players today is kind of a lost art. You know, I mean, everything, you're going to see dunks, highlight films with dunks and everything. One of the years, the most enjoyable year I had at Kent, Mike, was the first year. And if you remember, the team I inherited lost the top seven players, all
right.
Senior.
Yep.
Fremling, Wilson, Klintzing, Walton, Banks, Keith Killian.
Yep.
And the players I had coming back were like Rod Cook, Greg Holman, Jeff Anderson, guys that really didn't play that much. But you know something? They could all shoot the ball.
Yep.
And it was fun coaching those guys because they were coachable and they were anxious to get a chance to play. And, you know, you can win games if you can shoot the ball. Shooting covers up a lot of sins.
Sure does. Let me ask you this. I think this will be a good question to kind of wrap things up with, because it kind of goes, we can go backwards to your time and what you just described there when you were an assistant and a head coach, and then kind of think about how basketball is played today. When you think about the game today and just the way the three-pointer has sort of taken over basketball from the NBA level all the way back to, for sure, high school and probably even younger than that, and then you think about some of the teams that you were involved with at Kent or at Capital or at Heidelberg, and just maybe talk a little bit about what you think the impact of the three would have been if you think about some of the teams that you were involved with, how that might have changed the way those teams played, or maybe just the level of success they might have had.
Well, you know, needless, the three-point shot, let's see, that came in, I guess, when I was at Capital. It probably wouldn't have changed the way I coached, to be honest with you, because I don't think I would have opened it up to a lot of three-point shooting. I mean, the game has changed so much. I guess I should speak to that more. Remember at Kent, the main offense under Coach McDonald was a high post set?
Absolutely.
A lot of cutting off the high post, movement away from the basketball. Every team I ever coached was pretty much motion, you know, a lot of screening away. Very few ball screens, if any. I mean, flare screens, down screens, reading the defense, curl cuts, fade cuts, basket cuts, all that. If you watch the game today, everything is spacing and ball screens. You could change uniforms of the teams at halftime and still see the same.
Both teams are so true.
Yep. Because, you know, it's the NBA. It's the influence of the NBA, where it's just everything is ball screen, individual moves, ball screen, very little movement away from the ball, other than maybe, I would say, the Warriors. You know, I think, you know, Seth Curry gets a lot of shots because he's a great screener.
Yep.
He screens and out cuts. Everyone goes with the cutter. They switch or whatever, and he's smart enough, and he gets open, and he gets a lot of shots by being a good screener. But very few teams do that. Everything now is the high ball screen, and everything's off of dribble penetration. You go to NBA games, and you look at the workout coaches. What are they working on? Shots off the dribble. I mean, all this teardrop shots. I mean, step back jumpers, all that stuff, which we never would have allowed.
But now, you never would have worked on it. I think about the number of pick and rolls I ran from an offensive standpoint while I was at Kent. I mean, maybe I could count them on one hand. The number of times that we used a pick and roll with somebody coming off and me having the ball in my hands. So that's one thing. And then the second thing I think about when I think about my career, and I've said this before, but I can never remember dribbling into the basket, driving to the basket, and then turning around and kicking the ball back out to like the top of the key. Maybe you would get under the basket and throw it to the corner, maybe.
Sure.
But I never remember driving under the basket with the idea that I'm then going to throw it out to somebody behind the three-point line. You're always trying to set somebody up inside for a shot close to the basket. And the game's just totally different. And then I look at the number of attempts at shooting threes, the number of threes that I took, and I think, okay, if you took me from 1989 and you threw me into the game today, how many threes would I have been asked to take or been allowed to take? I forget what I shot, but you know, I think
I think a lot, Mike.
Yeah, I think I was over 40% at least two, maybe of the years or close to it. And you know, you think about, man, if you're a 40% 3-point shooter, how many threes would your coach want you taking at this point? It's just interesting to think, and obviously there's other factors that go into it, but it's just amazing how different the game is in terms of how it's played. And, you know, you talked about the motion and the screens off the ball and all that stuff. And kids today, that's almost like a foreign language, because it's just everybody, it's either screen and roll or it's dribble drive. And you're just trying to draw penetration and then kick it out. And so, I don't know. It's interesting. It's definitely a different game than it used to be, for sure.
It is. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I'd like to think that someday it may come back to that. I know Dick Bennett, who's Tony Bennett's dad, who coaches at Virginia, who does a great job. I know he runs a camp in the summer, and the whole idea of the camp is what you can do away from the basketball in terms of cutting, screening, all that. That's all he teaches, passing. I mean, there's no dribble drive, nothing like that, which is kind of an interesting concept.
Well, it seems like there's a balance to be had between the two styles. It seems like
Yes. You
can completely understand why the way that you coach or the way that I played has gone away with the advent of the three and the analytics and the math, and you understand why it makes sense.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, I watch a lot of teams that aren't skilled enough at the things that you need to be good at in order to play that way. Either you're not a good enough shooter or you don't have enough one-on-one skill to break your defender down and be a good enough passer to find the open player outside the three-point line. I just think there's a fine line that if you could meld those two styles, to me, that's what makes the most sense from a coaching standpoint and trying to figure out what you're going to do with your program. So we are coming up here on an hour and a half. So I want to wrap things up, Coach. And I'm sure we could continue to go on for
hours. God bless Jason for sitting there and listening to all this. Jason, you're a good man.
What's going on?
But this has been an absolute pleasure. We will have to definitely do it again because I think there's a ton more that we could dive into. And I'd love to be able to talk a little bit more about just your transition from being an assistant to being a head coach or talk about some of the lessons that you learned over the course of your career that we really didn't get to. So we'll have to make sure that we do it again. But I can't thank you enough for jumping on with us. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.